It's Radio Free America with Tom Valentine, the talk show for intelligent Americans. Now, here's Tom.
Good evening, everybody. Here we go again. Tonight, my guest is once again Colonel Fletcher Prouty. And we have been talking with Colonel Prouty about the living history, his own personal living history, about how it ties so intimately with many of the major events, starting way back at the ending times of World War II with the Cairo and Tehran conferences. And he carried us through World War II and into the Korean War, the end of World War II, and we talked about, well, it was so amazing to hear this, but he talked about how American weapons that were supposed to be used for the assault against Japan and were no longer needed after the surrender of Japan, we sent those weapons to Vietnam to a man named Ho Chi Minh. And, of course, this led to the war that was not a war, Vietnam. And that was the conflict that, even though it was 11,000 miles away, it ripped this country in half. The Vietnam War will always be remembered as a conflict that the people at home, 50-50, hated it, tried to support it. It was a mess. And right in the middle of the war, something happened. Something came out that became a sensation in the media. And these were called the Pentagon Papers. So tonight, Colonel Fletcher Prouty, my guest, we're going to start, well, we'll probably start around 1963 when John Fitzgerald Kennedy was still president and maybe had some ideas about removing the American presence in Vietnam. But he has talked about that before. So that's where we are. Tonight you are going to learn living history from a man who served as the liaison between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA. Now stop and think about that position. It's a position where he was the officer that had to help the CIA get their military hardware for their covert operations. Now, I think that's enough of an introduction. How are you tonight, Fletcher?
Well, fine, Tom. I was just listening to some of those words and wondering how we're going to package that in whatever we're going to be able to use out of 2 hours, because you hit the right things. We went from World War II and took all the arms that were not used in the invasion of Japan and moved them down and split them equally between Korea and South Vietnam, or Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam at that time, just for Vietnam.
And yeah, we might as well have advertised two more coming wars.
Right.
All that weaponry.
Right. And a major event of that period, and I think those of us that have looked at the record very carefully will accept the terms I'm going to use, that the death of President Kennedy was an American political coup d'etat. It was not just the work of one deranged individual. And I think we're learning that more and more. This morning, the New York Times had something very interesting, because Mr. Webster, who is now the Director of Central Intelligence, is asking for more authority to act when coup d'etats or overthrows are worked on in other countries, even to include if the leader of the country, like Noriega, might be killed in the activity. And this caused Senator Moynihan of New York to rise on the Senate floor and make a speech. And I'm only going to take a couple of lines, but it's amazing how these perceptive men come back to the same thing. He said he heard about the death of Kennedy, and then he went on to say, within minutes, Senator Hubert Humphrey burst into the room, tears streaming. What have they done to us? We all knew who they were. They were the right wing in Dallas. Now, Moynihan and Humphrey didn't say they were Oswald and some other nuts. They were Castro and his friends. They were mafia out on the streets. He said, we all knew who they were, the right wing in Dallas. So I began to plead that the federal government must get physical custody of Oswald, else we would never know. And late that evening, I went out to Andrews Air Force Base to meet the plane bringing back the cabinet from its aborted trip to Japan, saying to them, we must get custody of Oswald.
And with that, I have to stop you right now, Fletcher, but we'll return to that point. Yes, the JFK assassination was a coup d'etat, a changing of the guard, a changing of policy. We're going to be talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, Living History. I'm Tom Valentine. It's Radio Free America. This is Tom Valentine, and we're back with you live on Radio Free America, talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty. And you were reading just now the statements made by Senator Moynihan and attributed to him anyway in the New York Times today.
Yes, this was written by Moynihan on the op-ed page, so it's his own signature on the article. It is a part of a speech he made day before yesterday on the floor of the Senate. And really, the amazing thing about it, absolutely amazing thing, was how he felt right away that the federal government had to take over control of Lee Harvey Oswald before he would be killed. He seemed to know that would happen. He also knew that if there was to be any understanding of the murder of the president, it would have to put Oswald on trial, as the law says, and then let the case work itself through. But the really interesting reference that Moynihan made was this. Instead of saying that he went to Andrews Air Force Base to meet the plane with the body of President Kennedy and with the new President Lyndon Johnson on board, he said, I went to Andrews Base to meet the plane bringing the cabinet back from its aborted trip to Japan.
Now, you pointed that out the last time we talked. That it was one of the few times in history that the entire cabinet was out of the country.
I have never heard at any time in the history of the United States when the majority of the president's cabinet, men in office as cabinet officers, are leaving on a trip. They first of all had a conference in Honolulu, and then on the very day that the president was murdered, they were in the air en route to Tokyo. And so much planning had already gone into effect for their arrival in Tokyo that you can look in newspapers that were printed on November 23rd and 24th and oddly enough read copies of speeches made by cabinet officers like Orville Freeman, who was Secretary of Agriculture, that were made in Japan. Well, of course, he never even got to Japan, but his PR people had sent speeches out there, and the newspapers published them and saying, this is what Orville Freeman said to the Japanese on November 23rd. You know, the whole thing was packaged so strangely that these are the things that actually happened, and Senator Moynihan, you see, remembered that.
Well, my question is, if Moynihan and Hubert Humphrey and powerful Democrats of the day knew all of this, why did they let the Warren Commission get away with that whitewash?
You're getting right to the point, you see. President Johnson, the first meeting, and I think we said this earlier, but I think it's important enough to come back because of your question. President Johnson was two cars behind President Kennedy, then the Vice President Johnson, on Dealey Plaza in Dallas that day. The first question he asked J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, when he got a chance to see Hoover, was, were they shooting at me, Johnson? Now, Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover had lived across the street from each other in Washington, D.C. for 19 years. They knew each other intimately. And the president was saying to his director, FBI, were they shooting at me? In other words, that shooting was so organized that bullets were not just coming from one window up above. They were coming from several points, and some of them clearly passed right over the head of Lyndon Johnson. Well, these are at the root of these things. But more than that, we're talking about discussing the Pentagon Papers today. They're a strange set of documents. Almost, there's 3,000 pages of commentary by the people that put these things together, and there's over 4,000 pages of documents. In the 7,000 pages that were provided to the newspapers and eventually to the public, not a single line mentions the death of President Kennedy, which is remarkable because by omission, many things are made more strong than if you tried to fill in the details. Let me read just a little line about to show how the Pentagon Papers skipped right over this. They're talking about the Honolulu Conference of 20 November 1963. And they say that as soon as that broke up, the cabinet left for Tokyo. Then it gives a date, 22 November 1963. That's the day Kennedy was killed. The headline in the Pentagon Papers says, Lodge, our ambassador to Vietnam at that time, confers with the president. Now, for a few hours that day, Kennedy was president. And for a few hours at the end of the day, Johnson was president. Lodge didn't confer with either one of them that day, obviously. And here's what it goes on to say. Having flown to Washington the day after the conference, Lodge meets with the president and presumably continues the kind of report given in Honolulu. That's what 7,000 pages of the Pentagon Papers have to say about the death of President Kennedy.
Now, they just
get a message out of that?
Yes, you get a big message out of this thing. Well, that's what our whole show is going to be about tonight, is this huge, very celebrated discovery of the press, the Pentagon Papers. And it looks to me like, from reading your book, it was hand-fed disinformation on the part of the CIA or the secret team that runs the CIA that you talk about. Amazing information.
And you can see that things like this create major changes in the direction of the ship of state. For example, earlier in the month, President Kennedy, before his death, had signed a document that we knew as National Security Action Number 263.
All right, we're going to have to come back to that one because we've reached another break. But I'm still gnawing on the fact that the Pentagon Papers, 7,000 pages of them, skipped right over the death of the president. You're right, that's amazing. Stay with us. It's going to be amazing. Living history. I am Tom Valentine, and this is Radio Free America. Live on Radio Free America. And before we go any farther, Fletcher, my guest, by the way, is Colonel Fletcher Prouty. And we're talking about living American history, that period known as the Vietnam War. And something came out of that war that was a sensation in the media. It was called the Pentagon Papers. Now, I'd like you to, before we go any further in talking about these papers, tell everybody what they are and how you know about them. What is your relationship to them?
What most of us know was that on June 13th, 1971, the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and the Washington Post, and I believe one or two other papers, began to print excerpts from a massive stack of papers that we later found out had been provided to the New York Times, or at least to some of its writers, by a man named Daniel Ellsberg. Now, what I'm quoting for you tonight is from what I think is the most authoritative source on Pentagon Papers, called the Senator Gravel edition, the Pentagon Papers, printed in 1971 by Beacon Press. It's five volumes. You may see it on your library shelves as four volumes. I have five volumes right here on the table beside me. It's a five-volume work, and it is every single word and document of the papers as they were prepared.
Now, Daniel Ellsberg was what? He was in a psychiatrist's care, I believe, or something.
Well, that is what came out in the press later. But Daniel Ellsberg is an extremely interesting person. He worked on the Pentagon Papers study that was commissioned by Secretary of Defense McNamara in 1967. He was a graduate of Harvard University, and he had worked as an analyst on defense matters. He was one of four defense analysts at the RAND Corporation. And in the RAND Corporation, he had access to all of the Pentagon Papers. A note that lets us know that the RAND Corporation had all of those papers. He worked at MIT as a senior researcher in 1970, and at that time his people working with him said that he had copies of the Pentagon Papers there. He then went to Vietnam working for the CIA's most important agent in Southeast Asia, General Edward G. Lansdale. In Vietnam, Ellsberg was a civilian pacification specialist in 1966. Now, those of you that are pretty familiar with the Vietnam War remember what the pacification program was called. It was one of the deadliest programs that we used over there. More Vietnamese were killed in the pacification process than anything else except the bombing attacks. And Ellsberg was the civilian pacification specialist in 1966 in Vietnam with Lansdale, under Lansdale. He went through Harvard University on a Pepsi-Cola scholarship, and he got a Phi Beta Kappa. I personally find this Pepsi-Cola scholarship rather interesting. I recall that Richard Nixon, after he resigned as President of the United States, became General Counsel to the Pepsi-Cola Corporation, and that there are many other very strong political ties between the Pepsi-Cola Company and...
I have to throw in a quick aside here. According to what I have read, on the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Richard Nixon had been in that area, in the same town, and he was flying out at the time of the shooting, and he had been there with a Pepsi-Cola meeting along with actress Joan Crawford.
Good for you, Tom. But let me tell you something rather interesting. I have four different books or magazine extracts here with reputable authors talking about interviews with Richard Nixon.
Okay, we're going to have to continue.
Where was he when the president
died? They're playing my song right now, so we'll have to take another break. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Valentine. It's Radio Free America. This is Tom Valentine. We're back again live on Radio Free America, coming to you over the Sun Radio Network. We're talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, whose job was a liaison between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA from the years of 1955 through 1964. His book came out in 1971 and 72. It was called The Secret Team. You probably didn't get a chance to see it because a lot of them were scooped up and shoved down George Orwell's memory hole. But we are talking now about the tremendous living history just a couple of decades ago. And this Daniel Ellsberg is a man who gave or leaked these Pentagon papers to the media. And the media has crowed about this great coup ever since, that the Fourth Estate keeps watch on our government. And it may not have been exactly that way. So we're back to you now, and you were talking about Richard Nixon and this Pepsi-Cola connection here.
Right, Tom. You know, I hate to wander all sometimes, but...
Well, it's fun to wander.
Our job tonight and every night when we're doing this is to see if we can't establish within history some things that are true. This business of weaving history around to mean anything you want it to mean is not right. We're going to do true history. So let's talk about Mr. Nixon in Dallas on the day that President Kennedy was shot dead. He had gone to Dallas in his capacity as general counsel to the Pepsi-Cola Company. He met in Dallas with those people the day before President Kennedy was killed and on the day President Kennedy was killed. His story to four authors, and there may be more, but I happen to have four from books and magazines that state what Nixon told these authors where he was when the president was killed. And in all four cases, they are different. But in general, they say that he left Dallas on the morning of the 22nd and flew to LaGuardia Airport in New York City. He did not leave in the morning. A friend of mine, a man who was working in the White House, a reputable person, was lecturing at a school in New York, New York State. After his lecture, and during the lecture, he had mentioned the president's assassination only briefly. A young man who was in the audience came up to him and said, "I was very pleased to hear you speak about the day of the president's assassination and about the fact that President Nixon had been in Dallas because he was in Dallas with my father." And the boy explained that his father, who was the general counsel of the Pepsi-Cola Company, told him when he got back that the men in the room, including Nixon, heard the news of the president's death on a radio. He said they knelt for a moment in silent prayer honoring President Kennedy. But the young man was proving that Nixon was in Dallas at the time of the president's death. My friend, having obtained the name of this young man, went to New York City and went up to see his father, who was the general counsel of the Pepsi-Cola company. And he walked into the office, said why he was there, and what he had heard the son's story. And he said, this is counter to many of the stories written that Mr. Nixon has told different reporters. And this gentleman turned to my friend and said, my son told you the truth. I told my son that Nixon was in the office with us at 12:30 when Kennedy was killed. Now, the interesting story, to be sure that there could be no mix-up in identities, and my friend confirmed this positively to me, was that the boy who came up to speak with him at that school was black. The man that he went in to see at the Pepsi-Cola office was black. There could hardly have been any question with the identical names and the fact both were black, and that the father clearly honored the son's statement. Now, why does Nixon tell reporters that he was not in Dallas at the time the president was killed? I'd like to hear him answer that question someday.
Let's see if we can get him on the show one of these times. what the heck? I mean, he's coming back. He's making a comeback.
Well,
anyway, not necessarily politically, but he's coming back in many different regards.
Well, he's an enigma.
Yes, he is.
A very interesting man. I was working in Washington while he was president, and many of the things he did, I think, were as good as some of the presidents we've had in the last 20 years. But he has this other quality that's a little bit strange, and we'll see more of that as we go along.
Well, you actually worked with him a lot closer when he was vice president.
Yes.
Yes. Now, these Pentagon papers that we're talking about, this guy Ellsberg that leaked them, some of these papers, when you saw them, you recognized them because they had been on your desk.
Yes, that was because Ellsberg had worked in the Pentagon in an office that the Office of the Secretary of Defense calls the International Security Administration. It was headed by a man named Dr. John McNaughton, and he was Assistant Secretary for ISA. And his office number, I looked up the telephone today, I looked up in the telephone book today, McNaughton's office number was 4E806. So then I looked up Ellsberg's name, and sure enough, it's listed in the Pentagon phone book of 1965, and Ellsberg's office number was 4E806. The men worked right in the same suite of offices, and the ISA section is a very interesting part of the Pentagon. ISA is where White House papers, State Department papers, CIA papers, and many, many foreign aid programs, USIA papers, all come to the Pentagon. And this is why this four-volume, 7,000-page Pentagon papers is really mostly non-Pentagon paper. There are very few papers in the Pentagon papers that are signed by generals or colonels and so on. Well, Ellsberg worked in that office. He knew the work of that office, and he knew what all their files were. Now, my office was just down the hall. I worked frequently with ISA, and my office was just down the hall from there. In my office, I had 17 file cabinets of papers that also came from outside the Pentagon, most of them from the CIA. So when I saw these papers being published by the New York Times and the Boston Globe, I couldn't believe it, because the last I had seen, they were all top secret papers. And I recognized many that I had worked on. For instance, my boss, General Krulak, one of the finest men I ever had the pleasure of working with, appears in the Pentagon papers many times because, like myself, his work was close with the White House and the CIA. But just down the hall from my boss's office was General Dean, who was the J3, or the operations chief for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was the official in charge of all of this. His name is not once in the Pentagon Papers. They were labeled Pentagon Papers, but really they are papers from almost every other place in Washington that try to make a story of how we got into the Vietnam War. It's a very interesting chapter in history.
Yes, and this is what we're going to explore. In other words, the Pentagon had nothing to do in reality with the Pentagon Papers, but whoever fed those papers to the press wanted to make it look like the military of this country had something to do with Vietnam when in fact it was a CIA operation.
Correct.
Okay, we're going to continue in this vein. We'll take your phone calls in the next hour. I'm Tom Valentine. This is Radio Free America. This is Tom Valentine. We're back live on Radio Free America talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty. And we're talking now about the Pentagon Papers. We've established that these Pentagon Papers were very familiar to him. And let's go back to when you first saw them in the New York Times when they were first brought out. It was many years after you had seen them and had been in that office. You say you were really surprised and so forth. What was your reaction when you saw them?
Well, you know, when I first saw it on that Sunday, when I opened up my Sunday New York Times, June 13th, 1971, the headline had to do with the Pentagon Papers. And I was in the process then of writing my book that you've referred to, the book that's called The Secret Team.
Yes.
But because I knew this material was top secret, I had avoided direct references to the highly classified parts. But as I read that paper and the ones that followed the next few days, here I saw all these papers that were so highly classified being thrown out to the public. But even before that, on that same Sunday afternoon, about a week later, I received a call from BBC TV, and they wanted me to come to London because they told me that they had made an arrangement with Daniel Ellsberg to broadcast on BBC, and they wanted us to sit at a table with some of their experts in England for a full week of broadcasting each evening on a discussion of these amazing papers, which startled the British as much as they did the Americans. Well, I went to London, but by that time, Ellsberg was being charged with the process of giving these to the papers, and his lawyer advised that he not leave the country. But we had very good broadcast there in London. But the papers themselves were put together because the Secretary of Defense, at that time Robert McNamara, had decided to create a history of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam from World War II to the present. Now, it's interesting that McNamara's instructions to this group that was putting the papers together, that he wanted to study U.S. involvement in South Vietnam from 1945 to the present, which was then June 17, 1967. Now, he got together a team of 36 researchers, one of whom was Ellsberg, and the head of the team was Les Gelb. Gelb is the man that signed the papers when they were done as a finished product for the Defense Department. He now is the same Les Gelb who works for the New York Times. It's interesting to me that as he closed out his introductory comments on these papers that he wrote, writing history is a treacherous exercise. I wonder what he thinks of that today as he looks back over the period of writing this Pentagon Papers.
I wonder what so many Americans think that may have thought that these Pentagon Papers were, we haven't even covered the disinformation part of this that is coming up in the rest of the show. I just have to ask you one question. In your previous show, you said you have tried to find out, all these years, you've tried to find out who gave the orders to ship all the military equipment down to Ho Chi Minh, and this guy Les Gelb didn't find it either, huh?
No, that's... You see, this is one of the important things you have to know about the Pentagon Papers. They appear to be a total presentation, as McNamara wanted it, from 1945 to 1967. But they are not. They were very, very cleverly excised. There are papers that are missing. And the ones that are missing just happen to be the most important ones. Now, historians all over the United States use the Pentagon Papers as a basic research area for teaching this period of the Vietnam War and the origins of the Vietnam War. It's unfortunate that most of them don't have the breadth of experience to know that many of the most important papers, one we talked about, Tom, the NSAM 55 that President Kennedy signed and sent to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying, "I hold the Chiefs of Staff responsible to be my advisors in peacetime as they would be in wartime." One of the most important presidential papers ever written, and it's not in the Pentagon Papers, nor is NSAM 57. Well, this business of setting forth the history, so they say, and then leaving out some of the most important things in the history, as Gelb said, is a pretty treacherous business. But now, what did McNamara have in mind? And I think it's not hard that there was a very interesting book written at about the same time McNamara was having these people put together the papers. And some of you may have seen it. It's called The Report from Iron Mountain. It's written by a man named Lewin. And it's a novel, but it's only a novel so he can say some things that have to be said. Let me read a few. I think they're very important. He said, "The existence of any form of weaponry ensures its use." He's thinking about nuclear weapons. And he says, "War is virtually synonymous with nationhood. The elimination of war implies the inevitable elimination of national sovereignty and the traditional nation state." This is one of the big questions going around today, because is our country really ready for peace? You know, Ronald Reagan one day in the New York Times on November 15, 1985, made a very brief statement. He said, "My mission, stated simply, is a mission for peace." I'm just wondering what would happen if he ever tried to make that the sole mission, because immediately it's Ronald Reagan that spent more money on arms than any man that ever lived.
Yes, and that's, now we get back to the thing that I always bring up, Smedley Butler, and War is a Racket. Talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, I'm Tom Valentine. This is Radio Free America. Tom Valentine, and we are back with you live on Radio Free America. And we're talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty. Tonight we are talking about the Pentagon Papers, the sensation, the media today on the radio, National Public Radio. I was listening to a discussion by a group of journalists at some kind of luncheon. Bernstein was defending his book when he was picking on the media, and the media was defending themselves, and they were talking. One of the fellows got up, and they were talking about the Pentagon Papers being one of the great examples of the Fourth Estate keeping government in line. And after reading your book, Fletcher, I have to say that's a joke.
Well, every man for his opinion. But I happened to be sitting up there in the Pentagon at the same time that Ellsberg was sitting there in ISA. And when they were running this program on the papers that used to be in my own files. And I don't read it that way. So I'm trying to talk about the things that I saw happen during my 9 years in that Pentagon. And also some of the contemporary things, which, you see, Ellsberg was an intelligent man. He's a very educated college in England, Harvard, MIT work. He had a master's degree and a PhD from Harvard. He worked with Rand. How many of you know this Rand Corporation that is on contract to the U.S. Air Force most of the time? Do you realize that the Rand Corporation has as many of its men on the boards of directors of major companies, mostly defense contract companies in this country, as any other organization? The Rand Corporation, and Ellsberg worked for them. Now, among the people that McNamara had working on these things were many of the names. Some of the men in ISA at the same time Ellsberg was there are General John Vogt. You probably remember him time after time reading reports from Vietnam. Another one, General Russ Doherty, later on the commanding general of Strategic Air Command. Were these all people working in the same offices where Ellsberg was working? Another man, Townsend Hoops, Henry Cuss, Art Barber. It was a center of people in this organization. So that Ellsberg was no freak. He was no oddball. They did a lot of talking about his psychiatric visits to some office, but that was in the Watergate period. And not at all. He's a strong individual. And there were many others. I happened to know Ed Katzenbach quite well in the Pentagon at the time. And many of the things that these people were talking about are the kind of statements that this man Lewin is talking about when he says that the possibility of war provides the sense of external necessity without which no government can long remain in power. The organization of a society for the possibility of war is its principal political stabilizer. It's ironic that the primary function of war has been generally recognized by historians only where it has been expressly acknowledged in the pirate societies of the great conquerors. The basic authority of a modern state over its people resides in its war powers. Now, those are strong statements, but just consider what McNamara had in mind when he asked these people to write the Pentagon Papers.
Well, we're out of time, but I appreciate very much the leading up for our second hour coming up. My guest is Colonel Fletcher Prouty. I'm Tom Valentine. We'll be back after the news. Hello, everybody. Here we go again. This is Act Two tonight. We are talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, and we've been talking about the Pentagon Papers, those very famous papers that came out in 1971 that allegedly told the true history of the war in Vietnam. And the media, even today, the media saying this is one of their all-conquering uses of the so-called Fourth Estate, that the press has to keep their eye on government and keep things straight. Well, there's a good deal of evidence to indicate that the Pentagon Papers were not necessarily true history, but were someone's... they weren't even somebody's ideas of history. They were what somebody wanted people to believe was true history. Would that be a good way of putting it?
Well, they show the line of friction between the 20 years when the buildup in Vietnam had been under the operational control of the Central Intelligence Agency, and then by 1967, as it transitioned over to the military and began to become a large war. By that time, 550,000 U.S. soldiers were fighting in Vietnam, and this war eventually cost this country somewhere around 58,000 lives and $220 billion.
But those papers do serve a purpose, a self-serving purpose on behalf of the CIA in a way, because it tends to throw the blame onto the military for the war when the blame really should be on the CIA's covert capacity.
And they draw clearly the distinction between the CIA that we think of as an intelligence agency and the CIA that we're not supposed to know too much about as a clandestine operator. You see, they publish CIA's intelligence documents, many of them very good intelligence, but seldom used. But they don't publish much about the clandestine activities. And you asked earlier, well, you're Thomas Medley Butler, you know, and war is a racket. And mm-hmm. You asked earlier about how did it happen that all these weapons were sent down to Ho Chi Minh. Well, in the Pentagon Papers, there's a lot of background papers, and then they lead you to other bits of history. For example, do you know the name T.V. Soong, S-O-O-N-G, a Chinaman who was at the time of World War II acknowledged to be the wealthiest man in the world?
Well, Madam Chiang Kai-shek was one of his daughters, right?
Right.
Okay.
Chiang Kai-shek was his puppet. And Chiang Kai-shek had been at the Cairo conference with Roosevelt and Churchill, much to Churchill's dismay, by the way. And historians don't seem to realize that Chiang Kai-shek also was at the Tehran conference where he could talk with Stalin. But the main thing was that T.V. Soong, who saw in South Asia another empire to build, more money to make, was a personal friend of Henry Luce, the head of the Time Life Empire, and that many of the things that Time and Life published about the Vietnam War were, like the Pentagon Papers, extracted from these sources that delineated their type of thinking and not necessarily always the strict facts. Another friend of T.V. Soong, and a good friend, was Wild Bill Donovan, the first director of the OSS during World War II. When you begin to see that this kind of a team was working together to send Ho Chi Minh, it was Chiang Kai-shek that sent Ho Chi Minh back to Hanoi to declare the independence of Vietnam, and that along with Ho Chi Minh on that trip was a U.S. Army general named Gallagher and some OSS people, you begin to see the threads now coming from these powerful sources generated out of the Tehran conference at the peak of World War II, and then into all of these stories that we read in the Pentagon Papers. Now, I don't know how much of this scene Daniel Ellsberg was aware of, but he really worked at getting these papers into public. For example, on November 6, 1969, 2 years after he started working with them, he met with Senator Fulbright, who then was the chairman, very powerful chairman, of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he gave him a box of papers, which eventually were known as the Pentagon Papers.
Okay, so we have to take a break, but we've got this. We're now got to the point where Ellsberg's beginning to give the papers away, and he gave them to Senator Fulbright. We'll be taking your calls later. I'm Tom Valentine. This is Radio Free America. Valentine, and we're back with you live on Radio Free America, and we are talking revisionism tonight, historic revisionism, which is a term used for those who go back and dig behind the records that we were handed out, the handouts of history, to the real facts and put the thing into perspective so that you see there's more than just the Roosevelts and the Churchills and the Stalins that are playing on this screen. Behind the scene, you see there are the Soongs, an extremely wealthy Chinese individual, and there are banking interests and wealth and power interests. And they have as much or more of a role than those that we see every day in the paper. And tonight, my guest, Colonel Fletcher Prouty, is talking about the famous Pentagon Papers. And they may not be everything they were made to seem. And that's where we were. You just pointed out that he gave the papers first to Senator Fulbright. Now, there's a Rhodes Scholar. Now, Ellsberg wasn't a Rhodes Scholar. He went to King's College. But was he a Rhodes Scholar? That's interesting.
Oh, I don't think so.
Well, Fulbright was.
He was. Ellsberg was working. Ellsberg was convinced that these papers ought to be made public. Whether he knew them intimately enough to know that they were, as I would say, incomplete or not, he was convinced they ought to be made public, and he worked at it hard. For instance, after he had seen Fulbright, only a month later, Secretary of Defense Laird, who followed McNamara after McNamara's resignation, finally acknowledged that the Pentagon Papers study existed. But that's all. He would let nothing out. In fact, as Fulbright said later, Laird slammed the door on the whole thing, and even senators couldn't learn anything about it. On February 3rd, 1970, we're moving ahead now, Fulbright had some new hearings on the Vietnam War. As you know, there were, by that time, opposition to the war was very strong.
Yes.
And Ellsberg tried to open up a new avenue to release the papers through Senator Goodell of New York. But Senator Goodell was not reelected, and he claims he never saw the papers, although Ellsberg gave him some of them. And again in February of 70, Ellsberg gave most of the papers to a Fulbright aide named Norval Jones, and he was working everywhere he could to get the papers into public. To put this in perspective, in May of 70, our U.S. troops went into Cambodia. Remember when Nixon ordered the troops to invade Cambodia into the Parrot's Beak area, trying to wipe out the headquarters of an army that didn't exist? Then on May 13th, before the Fulbright hearings, Ellsberg said that having studied the documents, I wish President Nixon had access to this McNamara DOD study. And about that time in 1970, he made them available to an organization called the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, D.C. And again, in July of 70, Fulbright asked Laird to make the Pentagon Papers available to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and again Laird said no. In the fall of 70, Ellsberg became a resident fellow at MIT, and he attended a seminar on making news. He read a report there that gained him quite a bit of notoriety, and in the process, it appears that he asked as many people as he could about how to get into the New York Times and get somebody influential at the New York Times to publish these papers, still working on them. In September of 70, there was a 66th annual meeting of the American Political Science Association, and Ellsberg delivered a paper there. And in this paper, interestingly enough, he began an attack on JFK, on Kennedy, for the way he had handled the Vietnam War. It's a kind of interesting story, because the Pentagon Papers denigrates the role of Kennedy quite a bit.
Well, it didn't even mention him, as you were pointing out in the first hour.
Didn't even mention his death.
Yeah, it didn't even mention the assassination of a president, a huge event. But go ahead.
Completely skipped over. Didn't he just said that Lodge flew from Hawaii to Washington to see the president on the same day the president was dead. That's all he said about it. Then in an interesting meeting in August of 70, Ellsberg arranged for a luncheon with Kissinger and with Lloyd Shearer. Lloyd Shearer is the longtime editor of the Sunday newspaper supplement called Parade. At the top of his column, he's called Walter Scott. Ellsberg arranged for a luncheon with Kissinger and with Lloyd Shearer. Lloyd Shearer is the longtime editor of the Sunday newspaper supplement called Parade. At the top of his column, he's called Walter Scott on one column, and then on another, it's Lloyd Shearer, same man.
Mm-hmm.
A man who knows the present history of this country as well as anybody, but doesn't always publish it that way. He tried to talk with Kissinger about the papers and about the... They were at the Western White House out in California and got nowhere at all with Kissinger. He said that Ellsberg said that Kissinger had been one of the original advisors on the structure of this war history when McNamara kicked the program off originally in 1967. Ellsberg was in a position to know that, and that's rather interesting. Kissinger later on said that he had never read the Pentagon Papers and denied that he had any knowledge of them whatsoever. So Ellsberg and Kissinger are directly opposed there.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Ellsberg arranged a meeting in Boston on January 71 with Kissinger again. It was fruitless. He got nowhere with Kissinger. Again in January, this time Ellsberg called Senator McGovern. And McGovern told a friend that Ellsberg was a hawk with a bad conscience. In other words, referring to his Vietnam experience and his Pentagon experience and so on.
Well, that's not a bad definition considering the role you pointed out he had in 1966 in that pacification.
Pretty accurate. He said he's a recent convert on a war. That's what McGovern said.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always been concerned that Ellsberg was totally aware of the coverage of the papers. I think he was more the postman than the author, if you see what I mean. He delivered them.
Yes, okay. We've reached the break point. We're talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty. I am Tom Valentine. This is Radio Free America. This is Tom Valentine. We're back again live on Radio Free America talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, author of the book The Secret Team. It has to do with the CIA and the role the CIA took for itself out of government, the role of covert operations rather than gathering intelligence. They do both. They do both very well. But now we have come to we've been talking about the Pentagon Papers and the extremely important group of papers that were made public. They were top secret documents made public in 1971 by the New York Times, Boston Globe, and other papers. We're getting to the actual history of that event. You just said Ellsberg was the messenger for who?
He was the messenger for the power group, McNamara and his crowd, that ordered these papers to be assembled. And they did it for a reason, and we're beginning to get to that, beginning to see how it all comes together now as we approach the year 1971, when Ellsberg met with Senator McGovern.
Yes, this guy Ellsberg is driven. I mean, it's more than just a guy that says, hey, my conscience is bothering me. I want to get these papers out. I mean, he's doing it like he's being paid to do it. Okay.
And he's, you see, in the Pentagon, we'd have called Ellsberg one of the whiz kids that McNamara had. You know, one of the real leaders of that era. He's not just somebody off the streets that the Watergate episode tried to create with all the references to other things. But he's a very smart and concerned individual, and he's weaving his way through Senator Fulbright, and Secretary Laird, Senator McGovern, Senator Goodell, and all these others. And McGovern, in parting with him, said, why don't you go directly to the New York Times and the Washington Post? They'll publish these papers. They'll see their value. Well, what happened next? One thing we should remember. They were published on June 13th, 1971, and the Times had them then about 90 days. That would put us back into March of 71. In March of 71, something rather strange happened in the New York Times. On March 28th, as a matter of fact, 1971, and I encourage you to go to your library and get out the microfilm on March 28, 1971, and take a look at this. In the book review section, a section where you expect to find nothing but a review of the books on sale, Neil Sheehan, the man who eventually wrote the Pentagon Papers series for the New York Times, came out with a book review of 33 books, all about Vietnam, one way or another, under the title, Should We Have War Crimes Trials? Now, you see, part of the Pentagon Papers, and as Ellsberg puts it, part of his motivation was that he could not abide the ruthless killing of millions of Vietnamese and other South Asians, and that it was a crime on the part of the United States government to fight that kind of war. This is behind the view, he claims, that motivated him in this work, and this is the title of Sheehan's article, Should We Have War Crimes Trials? And then a collection of these books. That was in March 28, 1971. Sheehan visited Boston in 1971 and returned to D.C. with the Pentagon Papers. On March 7th of 71, the Boston Globe mentions this Pentagon Papers, the first public mention of them. A writer named Oliphant was the first one to write about the Pentagon Papers existing. And he said in his article that only three people had ever seen the Pentagon Papers. They were Mort Halperin, who, by the way, was one of Kissinger's aides later on, Les Gelb, who now is with the New York Times, and Daniel Ellsberg. So the cast of characters is beginning to form pretty well. Then on June 13th, 1971, on the front page of the Sunday Times, New York Times, we find a headline.
All right.
Archives.
Save the headline for when we get back. Telephone number here is 800-622-5001. We will go to your calls in a little bit. I'm Tom Valentine. This is Radio Free America. This is Tom Valentine. We're back with you live on Radio Free America, talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty about the Pentagon Papers and the Vietnam conflict and the alleged history. We're going to be revising history here because the Pentagon Papers left something out, the sins of omission, if you will. But right now we have worked our way up through this Daniel Ellsberg's compelling drama of giving the papers to the media. It finally came out in the New York Times. What did the headline say?
The headline of the Times when they were released under the over the signature of Neil Sheehan was Vietnam Archives, Pentagon Study Traces Three Decades of Growing U.S. Involvement. And included after his story, there were three full pages in the Times of verbatim transcript from various of the Pentagon Papers. Of course, in those days, they weren't bound. There was no single copy. They were just pages of paper. On July 5th, the Washington Post, which had printed them themselves, also said it was the most massive security leak in history. Well, that's interesting, because right then, the government charged Ellsberg. It took a while to find out who gave the papers to the papers, but eventually they found out it was Daniel Ellsberg, and the government charged him with this as a security breach. And the government's lawyer was Irwin Griswold, former dean, I believe, at Harvard. And he's a government attorney who argued the case at the Supreme Court against the publication of the Pentagon Papers and ordered the newspapers to stop publishing them until the case was over. And as you know, the newspapers won that case and then published the papers. Recently, Griswold, an elderly gentleman, wrote this, among other things, in the newspaper. I have never seen any trace of a threat to national security since the papers became public. Now, that was the man who prosecuted the New York Times and the other papers for President Nixon. I've heard historians say the same thing. They say, we go back through the papers, they're very useful history, but we can't find anything in there that really is a security breach. They're just sordid news of the various things that happened over a period of 30 years.
That's exactly the way it would appear. And it actually, you pointed out in your book, and you gave a beautiful example of it, something to do with a particular office in the CIA that's responsible, or in the government somewhere, that's responsible for getting all kinds of information and then making predictions, and how that was twisted by this secret team to, in the Pentagon Papers, to make it look like the opposite of what it really was.
Yes, and of course, the governmental code for that is that that's a cover and deception office.
How did you do that? I can't remember. I wish I had your book in front of me right now. I'm remiss.
Well, you know, my office was down in the Joint Chiefs of Staff area, and the precise, and I was Chief of Special Operations. That means clandestine operations. Right next to me was the Chief of Cover and Deception. And cover and deception is an office that twists everything so it comes out backwards. The reason for that, so they feel, is that if anything that we're doing that is highly classified becomes knowledge to the Soviets or to the Chinese communists and so on, they'll find this cover and deception sort of packaging a lot of lies, and they won't know the difference between what's real and what isn't real. Or in hardware, it's even more important. They'll take a Sidewinder missile, for example, and they'll build 8 or 10 Sidewinder missiles that don't work at all like the real Sidewinder missile, and they'll send them to some country with an aid program like Iran that might leak them to the Soviets, and then they'll have a missile that doesn't work, and so on and so on. That's cover and deception, and I think that's what you're referring to, Tom.
Well, this is one in which they claim that we wouldn't be able to win in Vietnam, and then the CIA comes out later and says, see, we told the Joint Chiefs you couldn't, and it was the CIA all along building the war.
And it was, you know, the CIA, there was a group in the CIA, and frankly, I must commend them, who in their intelligence reports, year after year, I believe they were under a gentleman named Sherman Kent, and their intelligence reports were accurate. When you remember the long CBS Westmoreland trials, how they hassled back and forth about who was right with these figures and who was right with that. In general, I would say that the basic intelligence reports, and I mean just intelligence of the CIA at that period, were correct. But they had been so mixed up with the covert operations being run by the same agency that a lot of us wondered if it was the same agency. They were so widely divergent. You know, earlier tonight, I mentioned that there is a fifth volume to the Gravel edition of the Pentagon Papers. And the reason it is it tears the whole thing up and says it like it is. It says the newspapers did not do the proper job. It said they were a cover-up story all the way through, and so on and so on. I'll let you read it, but you should read the fifth volume. But let me just read a few lines. It says, as of January 1972, all of these moral men from the Pentagon were still active in public life. McNamara, with a second five-year term, was presiding over the billions of dollars in the World Bank. Rusk was teaching history to unsuspecting young people at a southern university. McGeorge Bundy was distributing Ford Foundation largesse as chairman of the board. Brother William Bundy had been confirmed by David Rockefeller as editor of Foreign Affairs, a journal which seeks to present American foreign policy in its most benevolent light. Walt Rostow was heavily engaged at the University of Texas, sometimes known as the University of Lyndon B. Johnson in Austin, presenting to history as a benign Democrat, one of the grossest men ever to achieve the presidency. That's only one sentence out of volume 5, but I commend it to you. It says more about the Pentagon Papers than any of us can.
Now, the author of these volumes?
Well, of course, Senator Gravel. They're called the Senator Gravel. I don't know if you remember that episode. Because of the security problem, Senator Gravel felt accurate that these papers were not highly classified. So he stood up in the Senate and day after day after day read all 7,000 pages. And then having done that, they were published in the Congressional Record. He got the congressional record taken to Beacon Press, and Beacon Press published the finest publication of the Pentagon Papers that exists, and I'm sure it's in all your libraries. You should go down and read it, because although I have said some of the things about the Pentagon Papers are not accurate, much of it is accurate, because after all, the papers are published verbatim, and you can use them as a source. But remember that many of the key papers are not there.
Now, we've come full circle. We come back to the linchpin of the Vietnam conflict based upon your book. John F. Kennedy was evidently not going to go along with the military-industrial complex idea of a buildup in Southeast Asia. He was after the Bay of Pigs and everything. He definitely changed his mind, because you pointed out that he had these two directives that he made, NSAM 55 and 57. And he was taking the covert power away from the CIA.
Exactly.
The guys that had been building up these wars all over the world. And right after that's when he was assassinated.
That's right.
All right, we've hit another break time. I am talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty. We're talking living history. You might have a comment. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Valentine, and this is Radio Free America. All right, this is Tom Valentine. We're back with you live on Radio Free America, talking with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, and we have come full circle. The definition, or part of what should be the definition of a coup d'etat, is when the head of state is removed and a policy change is made almost immediately. Now, John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November the 22nd, 1963, and the change in the Vietnam policy took how long to be made?
Let me step back to show you why it was Kennedy that was hit so hard, and I think I'll answer your question better that way, Tom.
All right.
In 1959, when Eisenhower had been president for 7 years, there was no war in Southeast Asia, but there were activities in Laos, and the CIA asked the Defense Department to transfer a squadron of Marine helicopters to Laos for operations there. It was my job to see that they were transferred. We put those helicopters in Udon in Thailand, which is just across the river from Laos, and they were in actual operations over Laos under the control of CIA operators. Now, that was the only place in the world where helicopters were active. They were built by the Bell Helicopter Company, that at about the same time was going bankrupt because there were not enough helicopter orders to keep them in business. My office in the Pentagon was rather obscure. All it said on the door was Team B, and my name and the name of a major that worked with me. Very few people knew what Team B meant. But one day, a well-dressed banker from Boston, Massachusetts, by the name of John Thompson, walked into my office, presented his card to my secretary, said he would like to talk with me. She wondered how on earth this outside civilian had gotten into the Pentagon, and of all the offices among the 35,000 people that worked there every day, he had come to our door. It didn't take me very long to find out, because he said, Colonel, he said, my sources tell me that you have operational helicopters in Southeast Asia, and I am here on the interest of the Textron Corporation, a big textile company. He said, Textron is interested in merging with the Bell Company. But because Bell is almost into bankruptcy, he wants to know what their future is. Can you tell me what the future for helicopters might be in Southeast Asia? Well, I told him that all I knew was we had one squadron there, but we talked for quite a while. It was an interesting thing, because a few months later, there was an announcement in the Wall Street Journal that Textron had merged with Bell. In 1960, that squadron of helicopters from Udon had been moved to Vietnam. It was the first heavy military equipment moved into Vietnam for the CIA's military forces at that time. During the war, over 5,000 helicopters were lost in combat. I don't know how many helicopters were used, you know, many more thousands. Over one-third of the casualties, of the 58,000 casualties in Vietnam, were caused either in combat helicopter operations or just operational activities of the helicopters. It was a major part of the Vietnam War. Billions and billions of dollars were spent on helicopters. Now, when Kennedy announced that we were going to get out of Vietnam in October of 1963, companies like Textron and Bell, among others, knew that that would be the end of their program. There were no more helicopters being used anywhere else in the world. Or companies like the major construction firms that got $11 billion for building Cameron Bay, an artificial harbor on the east coast of Indochina, they wouldn't have received a penny because the building didn't start until the Johnson era. Kennedy had not approved that plan.
Well, for crying out loud, they could have come here and fixed our roads and highways a little better.
Well, I'll tell you, most of their job was in Texas before they went to Vietnam, but the Brown and Root Company, among others. There was a big consortium that went there. But this is the way these companies worked. And you see the connections that I mentioned between T.V. Soong and Henry Luce and Wild Bill Donovan and Alan Dulles' connection with the business world through his Sullivan Cromwell law firms in Washington, New York, are what is behind what Mr. Lewin wrote when he said that the war economy is what keeps the nation state going and is its basic power. These are very fundamental statements. And that Textron, Bell, First National Bank of Boston deal, which happened in my office, is about as clear a statement of why, shortly after Kennedy said he was getting out of Vietnam, Kennedy was no longer with us.
And how long was it before President Johnson made the change in the approach to Vietnam?
I said earlier in the program that Ambassador Lodge flew from Honolulu on the 22nd of November to meet with the president. 2 days later, President Lyndon Johnson approved NSAM 273, which carried out pretty much the Kennedy program, but very quietly inserted a few new things. And by March of 1964, he had signed NSAM 288 that was on and off into the big war in Vietnam. It took about 3 months to totally change the course from the Kennedy plan to get out of Vietnam to the Johnson buildup that led to the fact that over 8 million U.S. men saw action in Vietnam.
All right, we're going to come back to wrap this up with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, and I'm going to add one more stripe to his sleeve when we get back. I'm Tom Valentine, Radio Free America. This is Tom Valentine, and we're back for the wrap-up tonight on this edition of Fletcher Prouty. This is the sixth appearance, and I'm going to ask you to come back. But let me tell everybody a little something here. You were a flyer. You started in 1927, and my guest, he flew in some of the important, was personally present in many of the important events of World War II. He's talking about. His military career was quite distinguished, and as based upon tonight's show, you can see he was right there in the Pentagon of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a liaison to the Central Intelligence Agency. In between times, in between, say, Korea and when he went back into the Vietnam War, he had other positions. He has written books on aviation as a professor. Was it at Yale University?
Yes, I was at Yale.
And?
Bush was a student.
You also... Yeah, Bush was a student there. That's right. You also had a career in banking.
Right.
Now, that's the stripe that I want to stick on you. I think maybe we should have you come back and we should talk about banking, the banking industry in this country and the movement that's going on right now to audit the Federal Reserve System.
Yeah. You know, that's a big program. I'd like to see more done on that because the Federal Reserve Board has become too far removed from our own government and from the people of this country. But something else is happening, Tom, and probably you've noticed this as much as I have. Imagine this. Here's a few corporations in the United States and what they owe. RJR Nabisco owes $25 billion. Sears Roebuck owes $19 billion. Texas Air owes $5 billion. Kroger owes $5 billion. The Southland, 7-Eleven stores, owes $4.6 billion. Campo, the company that just went belly up with Bloomingdale's store, owes $4.5 billion. Goodyear,
yes.
3.9. Southmark, 3.8. Owens, Illinois, 3.8, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when they owe all that money, our major U.S. corporations are paying banks and other investors at least 10% on that enormous amount of money, while the U.S. government is paying uncounted hundreds of billions the same way. 54% of the taxes you and I pay goes to the debt payment, interest payment on the debt, to nothing else.
That's right. Now, we're coming to the end of the show. I have to ask you one thing. The Pentagon Papers, did they have any mention in there of this Textron Bell link or the $11 billion at Cameron?
Not a word. See, that's my point. The things that really matter, not a word. And look in the papers today. A new wave has begun, a new Pentagon Papers. They're talking about third-generation missiles, fighter planes going Mach 5 to Mach 20, the B-2 bombers roll, and a targeting system that is directed at killing the leaders of Russia first, and some other things like that. It's a new wave to go after more hundreds of billions, like Reagan did when he spent $1 trillion on the military. And you're seeing a new... See the Los Angeles Times last month, you get the whole story.
All right, we're out of time, and as ever, it is fascinating. My guest, Colonel Fletcher Prouty, this is Tom Valentine. It's Radio Free America, and I have to say it, good night, everyone.